Scary Era. Era is the Irish or Gaelic word for Ireland. Do you know much about this ancient land? In recent times, its Irish culture has revolved around the likes of U2, Pierce Brosnan and Colin Farrell, and of course the literary genius types of William Butler Yeats and James Joyce. They're all world-renowned, but it's a mystical place, this Ireland, from its Druids to its Christianity, and also brutal, surviving famine and invasion after invasion. Vikings, Normans, and the English. We've seen them all come, and we've seen them all off. Cheerio! Your ancestors kept your names close as over the rugged seas they fled to eke out a living or fight someone else's war. Paranormal means all the things that are impossible to explain by known natural forces or by science. And Ireland is steeped in lore. Ghosts, blood, sweat, tears, sacrifice, hunger, desperation, and charm. Oh, and the paranormal. Welcome to Scary Era. Fáilte is the Irish word for welcome, and you well and truly are. Hello, my name is Mark Manning, and I'm presenting Scary Era for all things Irish-related, paranormal, or ghostly. Before I say anything at all on this inaugural show, my thanks go out to David, Irene and Mark for allowing me on the wonderful esteemed platform of Paranormal UK. Perhaps you're Irish or have Irish relatives. It doesn't really matter. There's nothing that exclusive about it. But it would be lovely if you can give us an Irish-related paranormal story. Don't be a stranger. You can contact us at paranormalireland@protonmail.com. You can email your story, or indeed we can set up a little telephone call or Skype for you. How about that? And we can broadcast your story at a later date. What have the law of averages got to say about our first caller? Because he hails appropriately enough from, at this time of year, Skull in southwest Cork. This is Mark McCarty relating a few paranormal tales.
What I wanted to do is chat about an experience I had when I was in college. I went to college in Dún Laoghaire in 1992-93. While I was there, I was lodging in a house, and the man who owned the house, his sister, was a witch. Her name was Sandra Randami. She was quite famous back then, but she offered to do a reading for me, and I was very skeptical about that, of course, as a kid, you know. So I said, go ahead, sure, listen, what have I got to lose, you know? But anyway, she started telling me all these little things about my future and what it'd be like for me and things like that. It'd be all very good experiences. And then she said at the end, you know, you have a girl, a little girl standing beside you right now. And I thought nothing of it. But she said something very interesting. She said, it could be somebody from your past, your future, or your present. And I thought nothing of it. Look, I was 19 then. And a few years later, about 4 years later, I was in Australia. I was with some friends, and we were up in Queensland, up in Cairns. And while we were walking back from the pub one night, an Aboriginal woman called me over. She was sitting on the side of the road, and she said that I have a little girl standing beside me. And it absolutely freaked me out. It brought me back to that time when I was in that house in Dún Laoghaire, and I got such a shiver from it. So odd. It was just
Mark, I think the thing is, there's always an extra layer of scary when a child is involved. Very disconcerting. Absolutely. Because it's so wrong to have within that context an innocent.
Yeah, I know. Very, very odd. But that I told all the lads, and I was like telling a lot of people this. None of them believe me. They are all just totally skeptical about it. But I tell you, about 5 years ago, five or six years ago, I have a couple of kids now. I'm all grown up. Not very sensible, but I'm all grown up. And I was in the supermarket with my daughter, and she was standing beside me, and I looked at her, and all I heard was the conversation from this woman, Sandra, about this little girl standing beside me. And I realized that was actually my daughter standing beside me.
Oh, you know, that's lovely. It's like full circle, Mark, because in my mind, and I didn't want to say it, I thought, you know, perhaps in your family there might have been a miscarry or something like that, because you hear that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's a good story. It's a very pleasant ending to something that could have been very, very scary, because it did freak me out. But when I realized what this woman had been talking about, and the Aboriginal woman, was this future child who was standing beside me, holding my hand in the shop. It was bizarre. There was a few little details that both those ladies had said. And a split second when I saw my daughter in the shop, it was like, That's exactly what they were talking about.
Yeah.
Very odd.
It was it was like your moment, your revelation. Yeah. And a happy ending.
A happy ending, actually. Yeah.
A happy, well, you know.
So far, so good.
Any more stories for us, Mark, before you go?
I have one little one, right? I had this when we were building our house. It was probably 15 years ago. It's more now, 17 years ago. We lived in this old cottage in rural West Cork, like right in the middle of nowhere. And there was always something very odd about the house. It was a bit of a weird kind of vibe about the house. Now, it had a tiny little library, like a reading room off the side, which is very rare for a little cottage. But sometimes you'd go into that room and there'd be books on the bed. It was a little side bed. And that was always a bit odd. So you put the books back in. There'd be nobody in the house, like. And then you'd go back in again later and there'd be another book open on the bed, or there'd be books off the shelf, which was always a bit strange. And I remember being there on my own one night and I was upstairs and I heard somebody cleaning out the fire. Like, you know the way that sound of a grate, you know, when somebody has a poker and they're cleaning coal, that kind of grating sound. And I thought my missus had come in and she was already lighting the fire. So I went downstairs and nobody there. It was very, very odd. And things like that would happen all the time in this house. My missus could have sworn one night she heard somebody coughing upstairs. Like a cough. And you'd always hear noises on the stairs. I know it was an old house. So yes. Old houses make plenty of weird noises. But we had a cat, a black cat. And sometimes that cat would just stand and stare at the doorway between the little library and the sitting room. And it would move its head every now and again as if it was following something.
But so tuned in, cats. Yeah, I have two of them myself.
We moved out of that house. And about a year later, I got chatting to a friend of mine, his mum. And I was telling her about the house. And she's like, "Did you meet the ghost?" And I was like, "What do you mean, meet the ghost?"
What? Yeah.
We used to live there, she said. But we moved out because we couldn't handle it because there was a ghost in the house.
And it often harks back to the land it was built on.
Could be. Yeah, could be.
I heard the exact same thing earlier this year. I visited an area of Kilmainham late at night, and it stuck with me because there used to be an old convent, I think, on it, or certainly an old old people's home. Locals in Dublin 8 would know where I'm talking about. And as a young salesman, I was in corporate sales for years. I went in there you're knocking doors and stuff, and I found myself in this austere corridor. And at one point, a bell went boing, and suddenly it was like out of a thriller, out of nowhere. These walking dead, and they were old people. That's all, you know. But they were shuffling discreetly, probably for their lunch or whatever. It had been run by an order of nuns, and I think it ceased to be about 20 or 30 years ago. But anyway, I'm going around in circles. The thing was, I did a bit of research, and people were saying the exact same thing as you, that apartments had subsequently been built on that land. I think at one point as well, it was, you can fix me on this one. What's the word where people go to die? What's that called? The very one, right?
Yeah.
And that happened, but there were apartments on it and people were talking about books being moved and fights breaking out because... Yeah. You know, one would be accusing the other of messing with because they'd be sharing apartments and stuff.
Yeah.
So it does go on.
Some more interesting stuff there, actually, if you were to find somebody willing to talk about it. But there's an old asylum in Cork in the city that had been done up as a Victorian, I think it was. And it had been done up maybe 20 years ago and turned into apartments. And there's tons of stories of people of all sorts of strange and mysterious shenanigans going on in the modernized version of it. Because it was an insane asylum, and there's some very, very odd stories.
I'd well believe it, and would you believe as well that a lot of those people weren't insane in the first place?
Absolutely,
they were
that
in the way. Right, we had a huge thing of putting people away, even like if for the winter time, and then they'd release them again. So they became institutionalized. It was a thing here, and the threat was you'll be sent to the big house. You'll be sent to the big house. Yeah. So many as the sane person went in there, and if they didn't acclimatize to it, they went mad. Because some people did acclimatize, and they actually looked forward to going back in. They'd be taken out for the harvest and stuff. But we have sanatoriums because of the TB epidemic.
Yeah.
Those houses, so God knows what rattles around in them in the wee small hours of the morning.
That's it.
Mark from West Cork, it's been a pleasure. I hope we do it again. Wasn't he a lovely boy? And we'd love to hear from some lovely girls as well. So why don't you get in touch?
paranormalireland@protonmail.com. Okay, you've made it this far on Scary Era, so let me relate my own story to you as to why I've created this. In the early 1970s or so, I was, 8 years of age, and my father was an army officer in the Irish Defence Forces, and we lived in a place called Cahalbrua Barracks. It was formerly known as Portobello Barracks. It was occupied by the British for 112 years. Indeed, the building that I was in, the Irish hero Michael Collins, you might remember the Hollywood movie about him, he had an office in it. But it wasn't the big fella I woke up to one morning when I was about 8 years of age. I can still see her. She wasn't menacing in the least. Definitely someone from another era. Very serene, long dark hair and a blue cloak. I can tell you, folks, the hair does stand up on your head. And I gingerly retreated under the covers, and of course I was told to eat my cornflakes the next morning and to go to school. Nobody wanted to know, but that has stuck with me, and I'm 61 years of age now. That's why I keep an open mind on all things paranormal. My research yielded that there was a poisoning in the barracks in 1873, and a lady was up on a charge, but she got off. An Anne Winford Marshall. She was suspected of the murder of Gunnar Donaldson. He was found poisoned, slumped across a bed in an apartment. She went to trial, and despite the evidence being loaded against her, she was found not guilty. I don't believe in hauntings. I just think it's under certain conditions that events are replayed, perhaps where a lot of trauma was involved. I never could pin down the apartment to being our house, as the records went back with the British in 1922. I think they may be in Kew Gardens in London. Well, I went home this week and visited the curator of Cahalbrua Barracks, Noel MacDonald. We conducted our chat right by the main gate in the old guard room. You'll hear about summary executions, landmarks, and ghostly going-ons. I'm here with Noel MacDonald in Cahalbrua Barracks.
Hello, Mark.
And Noel, and this sounds probably a bit schmaltzy and overdramatic, but it's good to be home, because I said to you I spent 24 years of my life here. Doesn't matter where I go in the world, I always think of Cahalbrua Barracks, formerly Portobello Barracks, because of an incident that happened to me here, which is the only reason the Scary Era podcast was born. When I came across you in 2019, you had a Halloween type thing, which is appropriate, we're in the month of October. But you had your outfit on, your skeleton outfit. But as you spoke in this very room, which is the old guard room of Cahalbrua Barracks, I could tell how passionate you were about the place. I know you organise tours in here. What's your exact position within the Defence Forces and relating to Cahalbrua?
Well, I joined the Army in 1988. I'd done recruit training up in Dundalk. I came straight down to the 2nd Battalion, which is based in Cahalbrua Barracks, formerly Portobello Barracks. And I was involved up in the gym, so I was used to do all the gymnastics displays. I used to do all the big competitions, the military pentathlon, and I used to go abroad. So that was all very good. And then I got into being a barber, I went back to college. So I have the barber shop now, which is at the back of the depot where you used to live. And then I got into a fascination with the history of the barracks. It didn't become my job straight away, but then over time I was asked, well, why don't we open a visitor centre, museum? So I said, yeah, I could be part of that, I could really give a hand with that. And then I went and done a couple of courses, curator course and stuff like that, and eventually then I took over this in 2010, and I'm here ever since. Now, it's not a paid job, it's a voluntary job. Like everything, I'm a soldier force, so sure, I have to do all my military stuff. Still, I do that.
Of course.
But it's becoming more of my job now. So I run the barbershop and I run the museum. So if anybody wants a tour, they get in touch with me, I'll create the tour for them, and then I'll measure up to that.
Is there an email address, or how do they contact
you? Yeah, well, you can contact me. You can ring the barracks here, and they'll put you onto me straight away, and I can gladly give out my phone number. There's no problem if you want to ring me, and then our email, and then I'll create a tour for them, and no problem. And it's done so open there that it's for groups, okay, from 5 people, but roughly then we have people, about 15 to 20 people coming in.
Well, let's just set the scene first of all. I don't know, I really don't know acres or anything. Do you know how much acres this barracks is?
Yeah, well, it used to be 54 acres, now it's down to 46 acres.
Right, so obviously it was British Army established, first of all. It was Portobello Barracks up until, I think, the 50s when they called it after the Irish patriot, Cahalbrua. There was a battle as well here, it's not related, but a battle of Rat Mines in 1649, I think, between the Royalists and Parliamentarians. And there are fields around here known as the Bloody Fields.
Yep.
In terms of an operational barracks for the British, I think they were here over 100 years, so there would be a lot of regiments come through here.
Yeah, this is really a training barracks, and you can see back in the old photographs that when you look them up, you'll always see the lads training. And it was like tented villages as well, so they had so many people here at the time. But it wasn't just that it was an open barracks, it was like a statement. 54 acres is a huge plot of land, and it's prime in the centre of Dublin. So this is where people used to come in, do their training, and then leave from here and go to their wars or go wherever else.
Talk to me, because we're in Halloween at the moment, in relation to paranormally type things that might happen here.
Well, I have friends now. See, I'm in the barracks here a long time. I'm here since 1988, so that's 36 years now I'm here. And from talking to the lads that were here before me, and now talking to the lads that are here, I was on one lad I was on talking to yesterday, and I was saying that I had Mark coming in, and I was saying, where will I bring him? I was thinking of bringing him to a couple of different places that I would have heard of, that was guaranteed that the lads I was talking to were straight up guys, and they're not going to say things for the sake of saying it.
They're squatties, and they have other things on their minds.
Yeah. But these are coming up with telling me that it's 100% that people walking across the floors at night time, they're seeing things. Lights go off on and off. It shouldn't be going on and off. Other things I've heard myself. I've heard people talking in this very room that we're in, the guard room, the old guard room. Yeah. So it is a creepy, creepy place, but not creepy in a bad way. It's creepy. And I had a group in there a while ago. They were mediums. They're trained to be mediums. And they came in and they just buzzed around the place. They thought it was just open to everything.
I would have no belief in it at all, but I kept an open mind because of what happened to me here, where I saw an apparition as a child when I grew up here. But I think more so than haunting, I just think it could be atmospheric. Noises are, you know, this place here could be almost a capsule for a lot of energy. What, the guard room? People get locked up in here for being on the batter or whatever, for fighting. And so I think conditions can be played back, conditions of trauma or expellation, if that's a word, of energy, etc. So I'd say you'd have a field day, or those mediums, if they set up what's known as EVPs, you know, the recordings.
Yeah,
I'm sure there'd be many nights you'd hear nothing. But at some point, you would. My father was commanding officer of here, on and off. I mean, his heart was with the Defence Forces. Mm. He loved it. He was 40 years there.
But it becomes a family. It's a family.
So a couple of things as well. The first balloon took off from here to cross the Irish Sea. That was, I think, 1817.
Yeah. When William Wyndham Saddler, he was the man. And it wasn't that good. What happened was, the job was good, but he'd done to raise money, and he was going to sell tickets for everybody to come into the barracks. But nobody came into the barracks, and they watched it for free. So it bombed money-wise.
Freeloaders even back then,
bombed money-wise, but it was a success. They made it over to England. It was the first ever balloon ride over the sea. So you'd done very well.
The depot, what has been reported to you?
I don't hear anything bad about it, the hauntings or anything like that. What I do hear is that the lads, when they're staying there, and be orderly sergeant, they'll be there to mind the building that night, make sure they're up early in the morning to hand out the weapons to the lads, everything is okay. Mm. But they'd be telling me that they'd be sitting in the room, and there's people walking up overhead, banging doors and up the stairs. I myself was a witness that I was going up the back stairs. They'd be the Michael Collins stairs. Yes. And nobody uses them.
The big fella.
Yeah. So and I was going up there. I had to meet the CEO there at the time. And when I was going up the stairs to meet him, he was standing at the top. And there was somebody in the middle between us that wasn't there, and somebody whisking away. And the two of us looked at each other as if this was 3 feet away from the both of us. And we couldn't believe it. This was just... Now, I start laughing. The officer ran. He
ran for help. I have to stand up for the officer.
And we always heard it was later on. It was only later on that I heard that Michael Collins was known as the Whistler. So, and it was all about Michael Collins. So what I was going up to.
He would have been General Michael Collins at the time, but he wasn't actually here that long.
No, he was only here for a few months. But he lived here in the barracks.
He did, and in a couple of yards from where we are.
Yes, that's right, the Red House.
Were people sniping at that at one stage?
That's right, they were coming in.
The Republicans would have been shooting at him.
Yeah, but they were coming in, you could only come in with handguns because you were coming through the army accommodation and you weren't allowed guns in accommodation. Yeah. That's just a no-no. Okay. So you're coming in through the army houses dressed as army soldiers, pistols. They jump up onto the wall beside the house and they were firing in. And there's a clear sign of how we tried to get rid of that. So we blocked up a window there. They blocked up just to make sure that no bullets went down through the staircase and into his room.
Were you looking well for, what is it, 36 years of service?
36 years, yeah. I listen, the one thing that, Mark, that I do here, I have a passion for what I do. And I think if you have a job that you have a passion for,
oh, totally.
So I enjoy coming in the day. I enjoy meeting people. As I said, 50-odd people yesterday came in here to do the tour. The way they went on about it after, I just knew that I'd caught them. I caught them.
Because you sparked them.
Yeah, but that's exactly what it is.
You sparked
And it's
them.
Not because I get paid, because I don't get paid for this. It's voluntary.
Do you mind me asking what age you are?
I'm 55 now.
Jesus Christ. Like, I'm only 6 years older than you.
I'm 55.
And you're weight perfect. Yeah. Look at you. Are you running every day? Or
yeah, no, you have to exercise. The army is all built hard and how you do it, how you stand and how you portray yourself.
Of course.
So
posture.
If I come in here, like every morning, even now to today, I my slacks get ironed, my shoes get polished. You know?
Of course, it's discipline.
So you have to,
That's what my father used to say to me. We'll have to talk about some of the characters in this barracks. There was a notorious triple murder. Well, it was an execution. So what did the notorious Captain Bowen Coulthurst do?
Well, you see, it went back in the day that really we had to go a little bit deeper, because he was involved in the Boer War and he got a section of men and he led them into a skirmish where they should have been and they got wiped out. Now, he went back to the officers' mess over there and he got a terrible time off the other officers, because losing one man is a bad thing, but losing a section of men, 10 men, like that's just a no-no. But a couple of months later, he got another section to look after and make sure everything was okay. And as a captain, you should know your business. Mm. And a senior captain back then, he didn't take no for an answer. So to get another section of men, and he was told, you'd be very careful with this. But he got the other section, led them into a skirmish where they shouldn't have been, and they got wiped out.
So is he just army-barmy reckless, was he?
Well, if you think about it now, a good officer in the army will lead the men in, but he didn't get hurt, you know. So if you think about it that way, you go in there, he'll stand on the outside, which is not really the done thing, but that's the way it was. Now, he didn't go back to the officer's mess. He went to the doctor and he told me he didn't feel well over this, that this shook him. And back then, if you had mental health problems, they retired you. And that was it. Now, in 1916, World War One was on, and all the able-bodied soldiers and officers were sent over to the front line, Belgium and France. So what he had here were people who were after being shot, or people who were brought back in because of mental health problems, but they were brought back in to mind the barracks here because there was nobody to mind the barracks. So they were brought back in. People don't realise that. So he was one of them that came back in, and all was good for a period of time, and he was back in the uniform and he felt good. But then when the rebellion started, the bombs and bullets started going off, this started to really kick up in his mind. So he started to see things. Now, it just so happened that the night before, that Francis G. Skeffington was taken off the road because he was trying to hold a meeting down Harcourt Street, and he was coming up towards the Humpback Bridge, a group of lads behind him, just talking to him. But the young lieutenant that was on the bridge, that they were going to take over his position. Now, when they sent the young officer, when he sent his men out to get them, the young lads ran off. Skeffington was on his own.
And Skeffington was this pacifist character.
Oh my God,
wasn't
he? Pacifist. He wasn't into war.
A feminist than all these.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But they brought him up and they put him into the cell here.
Oh wait, but this. By the way, for those listening, we're speaking within feet of this.
And the place hasn't changed. You're
execution.
Right into the cells. You're right in here.
Two other guys got taken with him as well.
Yeah.
And I think
they were misidentified. That was the next morning.
They were actually union supporters.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. The next morning,
I think,
Bowen Coulthurst took over the duty and he got the two of them out. He got Skeffington out of the cell and he says, I know you write against us, because he was a journalist. And he says, no, he says, I'm a pacifist, I'm not into this. So he said, I don't know what to do with you. There's two snipers down the road there, just over the Humpback Bridge. And it was on the corner, just 100 yards when you go over the Humpback Bridge from Rat Mines. So you're going to a town.
On the canal?
Yes.
The Royal...
No. When you go over, just over the Humpback Bridge on the canal. So you're going down towards town. I think it's Hadding Road is on the left-hand side.
Oh, yes.
And then Harcourt Street is on the right. Right on the corner there was Kelly's Tobacconist. I think it's called Harcourt Health now.
Yes.
But next door to that was a coffee shop. Now, in his mind, there was two snipers in there. He went down, he opened the door and he threw in a grenade. Blew the shop out. One man died instantly. Another man came crawling out. Councillor Richard O'Carroll was his name.
That's
very prominent. Very prominent man. He shot him in the stomach. He's screaming in pain. At the same time, next door, the back of the shop opened up, and two men came out there with the explosion next door. He grabbed them two, and he said, "You two are involved in this." But Mr. Dixon and Mr. McIntyre—that was their two names. He got them up, and he collected Skeffington on the way back up. because he left him on the bridge just in case something happened to them. He was left there to be shot. But he collected three of them and brought them back up here to Portobello Barracks, and he put them into number one cell, right where we are now, and he put them in there. The next morning, he was told to let them go, but he came in, and he was told to let them go to battalion commander. He came in here and he says, "I'm after being told to let them go, but I don't want to." He says, "We're going to bring them out to the yard behind the guard room. We're going to execute them." And that's exactly what he done.
And he wasn't in charge of the barracks at the time.
No.
Because there's a good guy and there's a bad guy. And the good guy was the officer, I think, who was in commanding officer. Was it Major Sir Francis Vane?
He was a major commandant. He wasn't the CO. When he had heard what had happened, he said, "This can't be happening. This is absolutely outrageous." This is only a few weeks after. He went to the battalion commander and he pleaded with him, "You're going to have to do something here. He's after murdering three men. He's after burying them in a shallow grave in the barracks here. We have to do something here. His wife is after going over to London and she's in the High Commission in London. She is screaming because she wants a court-martial. We have to do something here." He said, "Okay." And that's when it happened. That's when they said, "Okay, look, we have to make this happen." And then it went to a court-martial and he was found guilty. Now,
insane. Guilty insane, but insane.
Guilty but insane. Yeah. Because he said that he was insane because of what happened to him over in the bar.
Of course, yeah.
Now, what happened was that man, the Major Commandant, Vane, he got let go then as well.
Yeah.
He got let go of the army because he told on a fellow officer. And for the rest of his life, he pleaded his innocence.
You've described that very well. Because I was saying to myself, it's just because the Brits couldn't stand what was going on. Because the General Maxwell, I think, he reported to. And General Maxwell was quoted as having said, they probably deserved it or something like that. But you've just couched it very nice. So that's what it was. It was the fellow officer thing reporting on more so than the actual moral swings and roundabout of it. That's very interesting. Coulthurst ended up in Broadmoor prison.
Yeah.
But the last I believe that was heard of him, I think it dates from a documentary I saw in the 70s, he went to Canada.
He went to Canada, lived the rest of his life.
And I think he won an election out there or something.
Okay, but he was a politician. He was an incredible way of being. Like, he had an upper sense that he was entitled to what he got, but he came from money. He came.
He did. There's a castle down there now.
Killarney Castle.
Is it Killarney or Bantry? Right. His people were from there. So if we go straight out the door here of the guard room and we continue going down straight, we will hit the depot that we've been speaking about. There is footage on YouTube. Just put in Michael Collins in uniform, Pathé, and you'll see him in what was our garden. I wish there was a lip reader out there because it's totally in silence. That leads onto a field.
Yes. Listen's field.
That was the house that Mulcahy had.
Yes.
And Black and Tans had that. We'll talk about them as well. They had it as a bit of a HQ, or they had it as a place at one point. Just beyond that is Rathmines Church with the distinctive
dome.
That went on fire at one point as well. And our acquaintance, Bowen Coulthurst, he summarily executed a young fella, a teenager called Code, I think.
That's right,
Code. Out there before the execution of the gentleman we just spoke about.
When he was bringing Skeffington down the road, there was two lads stepped out to ask where they were going. And it was Bowen Coulthurst said, "Martial law has only after been announced. You two shouldn't be on the street." He took out his revolver. Now, a Mauser revolver, which is very unusual.
Big German thing, yeah.
Yeah, and he took that out and shot Cody dead. His friend that was there ran. He was trying to shoot him as he ran, but he missed him. And that's where we got how we found where he shot the three men, because there was a bullet left in the wall. And when we took it out, it was a Mauser.
Mauser bullet. And what apparently, this is how callous he was. When Cody was questioned, he says, "What are you doing here?" or whatever, he said, "I'm here for my sodality." And sodality is a kind of, was a religious occasion or something you attended weekly. And he shot him in the head and with the words, "Take that for your sodality."
Wow.
So as you go straight down, there used to be an ammo dump on the right. It's gone.
That's gone.
There was the Aidacombs house, the two red houses down at the end.
They're the priest houses now.
The priest houses, are they? Or they'd be chaplains now.
Chaplains.
And the aide-de-camp to President De Valera and probably a few more was Tom McNamara. You'd see him on all the old 1960s, when Kennedy was here, you'd see Tom McNamara in the background. You're right, there was two priests that I knew of in those houses as well. One was Father Breslin, lovely man.
The Brez,
I forgot that. I think he might have been in the Leb as well, or Lebanon as well at one point. Breslin was a nut, right?
Character.
He looked like Tommy Cooper. There was another priest there called McCabe before him, real gentleman. This was a cavalry barracks as well.
That's right.
So they were old stables. You were sharing with me there are old tunnels there, or there was.
Yeah.
And they never appeared on any maps. That's what I was saying
tunnel.
To you.
We found tunnel, and it split in two. So when you went into the tunnel, if you went to the left, it went right down under the canal. And then if you went to the right, it would bring you halfway across Listen Field, heading towards the church, the Dome Church. So we only got halfway across that. Nobody else went any further. So I think it may have collapsed.
We cannot mention this place without mentioning the notorious Black and Tans. Yeah. Who were they?
Well, the Black and Tans came in, and be honest,
this was on Churchill's orders.
Yes, but you see, what happened here with them was, now I have the two houses where they used to stay here. So they'd be up at the back of the officers' mess.
Yeah.
That's where they used to come in.
Sorry, no. These guys were bastards, weren't they?
Yeah, well, they were. They
were like SS or something,
yeah,
without
they came
the discipline.
In to do, they came in to do the dirty
yeah.
work. Now, I was looking at a couple of them, and Pathé News, and they were interviewing them, and it amazing what was in their mind. Everything that they were doing the right thing. They had it in their mind that this was the right thing to do. Mm. And it may have came down from upper.
Yes,
the upper crust,
you can be sure it
that
did.
You have to do this. This is important. So they were doing the dirty work. Mm. They used to do the interrogation here. And we still have the interrogating places where they used to do it. He had a hanging house. But this is interrogation. So it was interrogation through strangulation. So what they would do is drop a rope down, tie it around your neck. You'd be tied to a chair. And they would hoist you up. So they were strangling.
That's real Spanish.
Incredible.
Thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, and then Inquisition thing.
And in this place where they used to do this, the hanging house, that's what we call it. What they used to do was that the people come in and walk there the next day. In there. In the right side and the left side of it. Only when I joined, the people used to come in. They'd be walking Saturday morning. One lad would be. And he's telling me, only there recently, he was telling me, oh my God, he says, the footsteps that used to run through that place and the screaming and the roaring. When he was there on his own, he'd say, yeah, enough of this. He'd lock up and go home because it started to get louder and louder. But this was common practice. Common practice.
These guys were called Black and Tans, for those of you who don't know, because they were kind of cobbled together in a uniform.
Yeah,
wasn't
the uniform
it?
Was the uniform.
Part auxiliary.
Yeah, but they hadn't got a uniform. Yeah, they hadn't got the uniform.
Yeah.
So they got a bit of both uniforms and they threw them on.
Yeah.
And they were known as the Black and Tans. But it was good
to see. They terrorised the whole of Ireland.
But you see, it was good to see because you saw the Black and Tan coming down the road because you knew by his uniform.
Yeah.
So that was a good thing. When if you hadn't been dressed like everybody else,
or were they all a mixture of officers or something? Did
no,
I hear that?
No,
or were they
the auxiliaries.
The auxiliaries were officers.
They were worse.
Are they the guys in the black uniform?
Yes, but they were worse than the Black and Tan.
Yeah.
They were officers.
Funny, I always thought it was the opposite way around.
No, they destroy it. The auxiliaries were even worse, yeah.
Right.
But then again, how can you get worse?
Okay.
What is worse? You know, because the two of them were killers.
No, of course they were. Laws unto themselves, essentially, because as you can see, when Colthurst was taken to task, it was all covered up by the powers that be. As you go up, you're heading to you go to the Garrison Church.
Yes.
Now, as a child,
St. Patrick's.
When does that date for roughly? Do you know?
Oh, that was one of the first buildings that was built in the barracks.
Was it?
Yeah. So you're talking about 1815 to 1820. And you see, if you think about it was all done religion. Everything was religion. So it's Church of Ireland Church. That's what makes it special because it's after changing over to a Catholic church. And that's what it is now.
There's a bit of paranormal around that as well, isn't there?
Yeah, well, you see, if you look at the church, if you're standing outside the church, you're looking at it, on the right-hand side is number 2 guardroom. So that goes onto the canal.
That's
so
right.
So you can entrance at the canal there. So if anybody's driving along the canal, you can look into the barracks there. But that was number 2 guardroom. And that's where the Black and Tans used to do their dirty work.
That's right, you found a bullet in the wall, didn't you?
That's right.
With blood on it that you forensically...
Yeah, yeah.
And you marked it all right. Do you have it on video?
That's right, do you?
Yeah, I do.
That's good, that's really good.
I have it not on video. I had a very bad phone at the time, but yeah, I do when I hear your dulcet tones and to do my research. As you move up then again, towards the mess, the main officer's mess, but up the top corner of the barracks... I think that might have been a priest's house as well back in the
notes. No, that was Sarsfield House.
Now, it didn't have, it's an exaggeration to say a moat around it, but it did have a kind of a drain right the way around.
That was the Quartermaster General's house. That's where the tunnel that goes to Griffith Barracks, that's where it's after collapsing, in around there. That's where it collapsed. Before you get down to that corner, if you back up a small bit, you'll have the old schoolhouse.
Yes.
On the left-hand side of the church was the old schoolhouse. Just beside that, what we're after finding was an execution wall. All the bullet holes are all still there.
And they're not Lee Enfields. What are they?
They're Martini Henrys.
This was an old rifle. Yeah.
Yes. Now you'll see this being used if you ever seen the film Zulu.
Yeah, of course. Michael Caine.
Okay. Hmm. And you'll see them further. And the one thing that you notice with it, that a plume of smoke came out.
Yes,
of course.
Can you see that? Like an old flintlock or something.
Brilliant. Yeah. Now, they got rid of them and they got 303s in. And that's what they used back then. What happened was that we took the bullets, and when we looked at the bullets, Martini Henry. And the only people who had the Martini Henry were the Black and Tans.
Really?
They were the ones.
Well, surely they were an older weapon. Why would they?
Because they had no weapons to give them when they.
Would you not imagine these are the guys that want to do the business, so give them the best, like the SS, give them the best weapons we have? No,
so they hadn't got uniforms. Yeah. So they did nothing for them. So they gave them all weapons that were there, where the Martini Henrys.
Have you heard of anything happening in that house?
In
that house, that's in the corner one. The
Sarsfield house. Yeah. We had a person here only doing a tour going back a month ago.
Yes.
And I was bringing them in. They said, oh my God, the memories in here. Like really, really vivid memories of strange things, kind of, you know. But yeah.
Wait till I tell you this, Noel, right? I've got one to add for you here. I did, I presented a TV program. It's now a long defunct channel, City Channel Television. And it was to do with the environment and all that. I got to know this guy. I was interviewing him, like I am you. We got talking about our childhoods, and I said, I was an army brat. And he said, so was I. Where were you? And I said, Colbrew. He said, so was I. I was up in that house. I said, that's Quinlan's old house or something, who featured in the film Jadotville, by the way. And he said to me, it was as haunted as, really? He said, yeah, there was a room there. It used to go freezing cold. And he was a bit of a me, because he said, you know, it bothered me. He said, and as an older guy, I rang one day, I rang a medium. And the medium was actually based in the UK. And the medium picked up, he was ringing from the house. He or she said, there's activity there, all right, but it's not malevolent, it's not menacing or anything. It's to do with horses, it's an ostler, I think. He's mischievous, but he's harmless. Noel, I was looking at the map for 1903 of the barracks, right? I'd look at that house, Sarsfield House. What's at the back of it? Stables.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, the gymnasium that you trained in, that's some building. I don't think many Dubliners are aware of what a fine building that is.
It's possibly the best equipped gym around. It's just amazing. But it's what the soldiers need.
Did Michael Carruth, the boxer, train there?
Well, we were all part of the gym team back then. And Michael would have been one of the star players.
It's a fabulous
really
building.
Good. And then we had other boxers there, like Phil Sutcliffe. Phil Sutcliffe done two Olympics for Ireland. Phil was probably one of the best boxers that ever came out of Ireland.
Portobello Barracks, it's also mentioned in Ulysses, in passing, in a context of a boxing match.
Yeah. Now, what we had was, that gym goes back to the British days when it used to be a gym. But 1916, they opened up as a prison and they used the cells inside it. They used
that. But it's ideal when you think about it.
Yeah, so if they picked up anybody down Rat Mines, they'd bring them up, they'd put them into the gym, they'd keep them there for a night or two, and if anybody downtown had seen somebody doing something, they'd bring them up here and they'd put them in a line and they'd spot them out to see who'd done it.
And didn't they have a bit of fun as well in the nastiest possible way by shooting bullets around them, making them stand
that's
against
right,
the wall? You
right.
showed me the bullet
chicken
holes.
Dance.
It's the chicken dance.
The chicken dance. Give us information or we'll shoot you.
Yeah.
And then they shoot all around them. So the bullet marks are still in the wall. Yeah. Now, of course, handguns be more, you know, a lighter round. And that's how the bullet holes are all still there.
Yeah.
Because if it had been a 303, it would have went straight through the wall.
And within literally feet of that, there are the old shooting ranges.
That's
are they around still or they're
no,
gone?
They're
they were,
gone.
They were
yeah,
well kind of gone when I used to play them.
Well, no, well,
there was the books down
them.
There, all right.
Yeah, well, we used to use
well,
them.
Maybe
still
2-2
used to
like
it's all 2-2.
Yeah.
All 2-2. But back then, you could make the FN rifles. You could take the
could you modify them
and put them in at 2-2
and
in.
Put
so
a barrel
we use
in.
Them yeah perfect
because I used to go down there and you know what I was intrigued as the amount of graffiti and
okay.
it would be dating from the Second World War and the 50s and all the servicemen that had gone through there. So is that
that'd be a training wall. See, we used to use them walls every morning.
Yeah,
you'd be thrown over the walls. There were 10 walls and they were all 7-8 foot high and you'd be made get over them. You know, so that was your training there, you kind of.
NCO's mess, is it still knocking around in that
NCO's
neck of the
mess
wood?
Is still the exact same down the corner. We used to have the sergeant's mess was across the road, but that went into the military archives, took that over. So now they have a lot of their paperwork in there. And then you'd have the bomb disposal unit, and then you'd have right down to where Skeffington was executed and the Michael Collins house.
So you discovered, you did a bit of detective work yourself for years. Right behind this guard room, there was a little ornate garden, and I was a child, and I used to go down
little
and
pond.
Little pond. That's right, the little pond. God, that's going back. The little pond, and it was flowers, or there was a plaque on the wall where the three guys had been. But that's not where they were shot.
Well, or was it? See, I tell you what happened. When they were shot, he said, bring them out to the yard behind the guard room, we're going to execute them. Now, when I went into looking at it, the ladies that were at the gate was Hannah Shee, Skeffington, Mr. Dixon and McIntyre. It was their family. Their ladies were at the gate here. Now, when I went more into it, it just didn't make sense to say that they were shot in the yard that belonged to the guard room. It just didn't make sense because it's only literally 10 yards away from the gate. So, but yet the ladies never heard that the men got executed to 3 days after. The battalion commander's office, and the battalion commander told him to let them go. He gave him an order to let the three men go. His office is attached to the guard room. It's attached here to the guard room. He never heard the shots. So the more I looked into it, the more I said, this just doesn't sound right. Now, I went more into it than that. I went more in depth. And then I said, do you know the barracks was broken back then into two different places? There was the hospital area and there was the barrack area.
Yes.
And then it was more investigating that I realised that there was a hospital yard. So when he said bring them out to the yard behind the guard room, did he mean the hospital yard to get them away from the gate? And I believe that he brought them to the hospital yard, which is about 100 yards down. But the hospital yard was kind of in a C, a letter C shape. And he brought them behind that. So any noise or any volley of shot that went off would have went off the building and the other direction. Also, you had the range that we were just talking about. That's just up the way. So it would have been common, his shots coming from there. So it wouldn't have been unheard of to hear something in the distance. That would be common. But to hear something come from the yard here, absolutely no, because nobody heard it. So I went up, had a look. Not only did we find where they took the bricks out of the wall to try to disguise what he'd done, because the bullets went through the bricks, went through the men and through the bricks, destroyed the bricks. So we found that the bricks were freshly put in. Also, we found a hole in the brick, and we went in and investigated with x-ray machines from the bomb disposal. We found there's a round cell in the wall.
It's still there?
Still there. We pull it back. We took it out. We sent it off. It's a Mauser round. And what gun?
Oh, your man Coulter's had his Mauser.
He used a pistol. But he was involved in it as well. So I always wondered, why did he bring two men out to shoot three men? And it was only then that I realised. But the bullet went through a tree. See, what he said was, bring them down to have a cigarette. And this, when they went down, they stood underneath the tree. See, there's no tree going to ever be in the guard room. This is what made me think. But so when they went down, they lit up a cigarette. And as soon as they did, they cocked the weapons and they fired on the men. All the evidence is still there. So we got the bullet out, we had the look, we put it back in the wall. The shallow grave, that is still there. So what we done was that we cleaned up the whole area. The bodies were exhumed by the officers that were here in the barracks while the court case was going on. And they were given back to the families because the officers didn't want people outside to think that they were murderers. So they took the bodies up. They got in touch with the families and they even paid money for them to be buried. Two were buried in Glasnevin and one's buried in Dean's Grange. Then they covered up the area. It's like everything else. You get a dog buries a bone, he digs it up, takes the bone out a week later. When you put the dirt back, over time with rain, it'll sink. You'll often get that bevel like a bowl. Mm. That's exactly what we found up there to where the lads were buried. And that's how we knew where they were buried. The tree is right beside it where they stray, and the bricks are out of the wall, and yet the bullet is still in the wall.
Well, fair play to you, because, I mean, you rewrote history to a degree.
Well, do you know what? It's as I said, it's a passion that I have, so it's not work.
And you know, you've just triggered something else off. We were talking about Sarsfield House, but just beyond that, it's occurred to me that sometime not that long ago in contemporary times, there was a bunch of skeletons found.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it was around the back. It was around the back.
Date them to the military. Maybe it's the Battle of Rat Mines or...
God knows. Going back that far. They came up because we started up allotments there.
Yes.
There used to be a lot of allotments.
We had one, years ago at the Garrison Church.
Right, okay.
Near where the flats are.
Okay.
Sorry, but anyway, you're saying...
Well, around the corner from that, around it is where they were found. There was skeletons found there. I think it happened before. It happened at the back of the gymnasium as well. There was a couple of bodies found there. Skeletons found back there. But you could be talking about 1700s. You could be talking way, way back.
Well, no.
See, it's old land.
We've just toured the whole barracks virtually, and I hope you've enjoyed it. But nobody will have done it more justice or have explained things more comprehensively. The blood of the place runs through you, Noel, than your good self. So Noel MacDonald, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure and a revelation to me as well. Much I didn't know.
It's a pleasure. And do you know what? I'm delighted you came in. What I will say is that if you have any listeners and are interested in it,
sure,
get in touch with the barracks and ask me in touch with Noel, and then I'll organise a a tour and make sure that they have a good day.
Well, the inaugural Scary Era podcast was built right around here and it couldn't have gotten off to a better start, and I'll make sure that that happens. Thanks again, Noel.
Thanks. Cheers.
If you've got an Irish paranormal experience you'd like to share, get in touch, paranormalireland@protonmail.com.
I have a feeling, my dear, you're going to enjoy this quite a lot.
Earlier this week, the Squire David McGlynn plonked himself into the Scary Era studio and told us all about the northeast of Ireland. I could not start a Scary Era episode without my bachelorhood friend. Welcome, the Squire McGlynn.
Hello.
Yes, he's a man of few words, but in his time he was known as the Catch of the County. Why was that, David?
I tended to catch quite a lot of things.
He did, and we won't go into that here, but...
Most of them were treated. Some of them have recurred, none of them permanently.
When I met this guy, the Squire, David McGlynn, I arrived in this outfit. It was it's the closest thing to being in Goodfellas.
Tan-coloured BMW 520 diesel, I think you were driving at the time. That was your company car.
Was it? I couldn't
tell. Or it might have been a light.
I just knew I'd been headhunted. I knew I had jumped on the Titanic and I bid my time, but I sure as hell wasn't. I wasn't going to go down with it. There I was in the corridors one day, and this spectacle. Do you remember the red spectacles? Very 80s. Actually, it was early 90s, but you did spectacles. He had the suit, probably Hugo Boss, walking along.
It would have been Yves Saint Laurent.
You, by the way, were the first person to talk to me about laptop computers. And I subsequently made quite a nice living out of laptop computers.
It was actually called a compatible luggable at the time. It was like a small suitcase, but very heavy. Came out of the IBM PS1, which was the very first personal computer, PC, in any office in the world. That's how old we are.
I don't doubt a scintilla of that. But we're here to talk about the northeast of Ireland, which is imbued, it's steeped, it's immersed in history. Am I correct?
It's actually the place where it's believed that St. Patrick arrived in around the 6th century, 5th century. But way before that, the Irish as a race arrived through the Iberian Peninsula. So basically the Basque region of northern Spain. We all basically come from there. And the first people to arrive were the Milesians.
That sounds like a disease.
Sorry. It does sound similar to lesions, but it's not quite the same thing. But the Milesians were... Middle East kind of area.
They were dark skinned with blue eyes, so I heard.
Could have been.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know about that. They arrived, and it's believed they arrived. St. Patrick arrived at the Boyne. That was the first place he arrived in, and then travelled from there throughout Ireland. The Milesians arrived in the same place,
okay,
which is the Boyne, which is northeast, which is what we're, exactly the area we're talking about. Their king was called Amagin, and he's believed to be buried underneath Millmount. Millmount is in Drogheda. So Amagin, who is a famous, I believe, poet, was the king of the Milesians, the first people to arrive in Ireland. They arrived in the northeast.
I want to talk just about a few of these spots in the northeast. Of course, probably the world-renowned Newgrange would be the place to start. It's a Neolithic, I'm told, tomb. It's 3,200 years old, David.
At least.
Yes, which makes it older. Sorry, English people, older than Stonehenge. It's older than the pyramids.
Yeah, it's older than both. Stunning place. What can I say about Newgrange?
Talk to me about the solstice. What happens?
Solstice happens around the 21st, 22nd of December every year. And it's the end of the winter cycle of the sun. And basically this place has been built in such a way that at a certain time on the morning of the 21st or 22nd of December, the sun comes through a slit in a piece of stone which is above the doorway to Newgrange. Newgrange is a tomb. So there is a passageway into the main chamber of the tomb. There's a slit in the stone above the doorway. And light comes in from the rising sun through that slit in the stone and illuminates the entrance.
The whole chamber.
It eventually reaches the back of the hallway, which is the walkway up to the chamber itself, and then illuminates the whole chamber. And this happens just once a year at this particular time of the solstice. The brains or intelligence needed at that time to be able to construct something that would achieve that is just
phenomenal.
Unimaginable.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. How did they think it up? They obviously spent a long, long time watching the sun, everything about the seasons.
Well, the first time I heard about it was... Do you recall a show called Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World? That aired. I heard him say, this is older than the pyramids.
can be very cloudy. A lot of people are disappointed.
It's a bit like watching the Northern Lights and asteroids in the far off night sky. Complete waste of time if it's cloudy. And if it's cloudy at all, you won't see it. It doesn't happen. So you have to have completely clear skies for the sun to be able to shine.
And there's a waiting list on this, and people are picked every year.
There's a lottery. You can put your name on a waiting list, and there's a lottery every year, and you can get to go inside the tomb. I put my name down on that list probably about 15, 20 years ago, and have never heard a word since. That's how difficult it is. So it's very much a lottery.
Northeast, it's a bloody place. And David, one of his pied de terres, it's a fancy word. What's that mean, David? I don't even know myself.
It means foot on the ground.
Oh, right. Well, I did know, right? Frickin' egghead. So he had a gate lodge, right? The colonel, it was old British Army influence. And David, as a young bachelor, decided that...
He was a major, actually.
Was he a major?
He was a major.
Well, sure, that's less than a colonel, as you know.
Well, he always corrected everybody that he was a major.
So I want to talk about this place. It was a gate lodge of a big house. Was it a farmhouse? What was it? What was the major involved in? He was very brave, by the way, to be a British Army major and living up that neck of the woods.
What was actually very funny about him, and I don't remember his name, but what was very funny about him was that he was very eccentric, very British. West Brit, as he would be called in Ireland, and a West Brit would be somebody who the Irish would consider English, or who have somebody who has an affinity to England. But the major was a retired British Army major, and when he left, his responsibility in Ireland was to recruit for the British Army, and that was actually his job. Well, that's what he always
good
told
luck
us.
With that.
That's what he always told us. And he drove around in a battered old
he red drove around in an armored car I'd armored say
car. Drove around in a battered old red BMW 3 series, and it was an 80s 3 series Beamer with a Maltese cross.
So he could give mouth-to-snout resuscitation if to any of the animals keeled over.
John of God, it was more to do with colonialism and owning Malta.
Yeah, oh, God. Well, I remember this. Sorry, I need to bring you back to the Gate Lodge. So you inhabited that as a kind of a bachelor pad. We would nurse hangovers there.
Yeah.
And you would hold little kind of mini, like microcosmic baronial meals for the invited, at which I was one. And I was asked by you, did I want, what's that cheese?
I think soiree is a nicer word.
Soiree, yeah, baronial is a bit.
Too small to be baronic, is there such a word?
Folks, sorry, we will get back to the paranormal. We were having some kind of spaghetti, and you said to me, would you like some Parmesan cheese with that? And I said, yes, please, David. And you told me to F off, that you didn't have any. So that's what you were dealing with. But let's set the scene. This place, if I remember correctly, was set on, was it the battleground or a site of the Battle of the Boyne?
No, I'm shaking my head. No, the battle site of the Boyne is just beside the Boyne River. So it's a couple of miles away from there.
So what was that, 1690-something, was it?
1690.
Or 1690. Explain to the people what the Battle of the Boyne was. Just roughly, a thumbnail sketch. Prince William, or King William, was it, or of Orange?
King William of Orange was drafted in, now this is very, very roughly, so the best thing to do is research this if you want accurate. King William of Orange, who was Dutch, was drafted in by the royal family of the UK to take over the crown of England. And it was around the time of James I. James I was a Catholic, William of Orange was a Protestant. And as with most of Irish history, it's all to do with religion. So basically, William of Orange arrived here to have a battle against James I. And James I at the time was the king of the United Kingdom and Ireland, or at the time it was Great Britain and Ireland. So he had, a lot of his troops were Irish Catholics against their own people. It was very confusing.
Yes.
But it happened, basically it was the last major battle of its type on Irish soil that I can remember. And William of Orange won the battle. James I fled the battlefield in disarray. And there's a story that he was on his way to Dublin. He stopped at a hostelry, and it was said to him, or he was asked why he was where he was. And he said, oh, everybody ran away from the battlefield. Everybody betrayed me. And the person who asked him the question said, well, that's unusual, because you're the first to arrive, which obviously means he ran before.
Yeah,
him.
Yeah, sure.
Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it's one of the stories out of it. So 1690, still a major...
Of course, it ramifications to this day. Luckily, we seem to be over the worst of it. There's a pretty It's always just below the surface, but détente has ruled supreme since 1998 or so. And let's hope it stays that way.
Yeah, we don't seem to have any problems, really. There's still an underbelly.
You'll always get that.
It doesn't tend to rear its ugly head, and we're in relative peace these days.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stick with the blood end of things. You're a Drogheda man, right? It was sacked by our friend. Who's the baddie that did all the killing? In
Oliver Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell.
Warts and all.
Yeah, he was in opposition to the crown in the UK at the time, an anti-royalist. Charles I was on the throne at the time. Cromwell got together what was called the New Model Army and basically set off against the crown. Part of his insurrection involved trying to overtake parts of Ireland, one of which was Drogheda. There are other battles as well, but Drogheda was a particularly gruesome and bloody one.
The sacking of Drogheda, that was men, women and children, really, wasn't it? It was just horrendous.
There are various reports about what happened there. There are reports of over 2,500 men, women and children being slaughtered by Cromwell's troops. There are differing opinions on that. I personally know an historian who's written a few books on the subject, and he brought up a very, what I find interesting, point. And he said, if 2,500 to 3,000 people were actually slaughtered, where are the skeletons? There are no skeletons. No bodies have been found in that kind of number. No mass graves have been found with all of the archaeological digging and stuff that has gone on in the area, of which there's plenty. There's no actual proof. But that doesn't serve the narrative of people who want to paint Cromwell as an absolute
evil monster.
Evil monster, which no doubt he was to a certain extent. But I think there's more to it than that. There seems to be, it looks like he got a very bad rap. He was very, very heavily supported at the time. Everybody thought he was great, and yeah, Everybody turned on him. And history is written by the victors, and he wasn't a victor for very long. And the ones that came after are the ones that wrote his history.
But he did something. I mean, he really overthrew the monarchy. And yeah, I mean, as far as you can get, which was beheading the king, kind of thing.
Charles I was beheaded.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, and you can obviously say no, and it's a quick, but just when we talk paranormal and ghosts and stuff like that, anything ever happened to David McGlynn?
Yeah, a couple of things over the years, but I've learned, well, I suppose it's not learned. I've just become accustomed to it, and I think it's kind of, it's maybe another sense or something. Mm. But often when you go into places, you'll get a feeling for the place, and you'll get a feeling of whether or not it's comfortable for you. And whatever causes that, who knows what causes that? But we have an intuition. We have an inbuilt intuition. I can't describe what it is or where it comes from or how, the physics of it or the chemistry of it, but it's there. And anybody will tell you to stick with your intuition. If you think something doesn't feel right, then don't hang around. I've had that feeling quite a few times over the years. There's a few different stories. There was one which actually happened in Drogheda. A friend of mine and myself were walking home one night from the pub, and I have to add, we hadn't imbued pints. We had two drinks. We were both 19 years old at the time, and we passed a place called Tommy Hanratty's. Tommy Hanratty's is a pub that had been there for at least a couple of hundred years. And as we were walking past this place, it was about 12:30 at night, an old guy in a long woolen coat, long black woolen coat, wearing what I later found out was a Homburg hat, which is a type of trilby, but very specific to the turn of the century, Edwardian era. It's very, very specific type of hat. And the reason I know that now is because I was trying to describe him to so many people, but I couldn't describe the hat. Just as we were turning a corner, this figure came around the corner, said good evening, lifted his Homburg hat, and that was it, basically. And I said to him, good night. My friend, who had carried on a couple of steps further, turned around and said to me, who are you talking to? And I said, the old guy. Did you not see him? The old guy who just came around the corner. And he said, nobody's just come around the corner. I didn't think an awful lot of it until the next day. I had to go to Tommy Hanratty's pub, and I went in there ostensibly for a pint. But while I was in there, I asked, actually, the guy's name behind the bar is Tommy Hanratty.
Wow.
He's related to his grandfather opened the pub originally. And I said to him, was your dad around or was your granddad around? And he said, my grandfather's been dead for years.
Jeepers.
And I said, well, we were walking past last night, and an elf fella in a long black coat wearing a big black hat said goodnight to us out of nowhere. And he said, that's my grandfather. In Ireland, it would be, that happens all the time. That's nothing. That's common occurrence. We discussed briefly what the guy looked like. Said, yeah, it happens all the time in the same place. We get that all the time. And he was very offhand about the whole thing, to be totally honest.
Mm.
But that was one story. There are a couple of others. I'm sure I saw my grandmother once I'd never seen my grandmother. She died before I was born. But I was in growing up in a house in Birmingham, and she appeared in the ceiling above my bed. Just looking at me. As far as I just saw an old woman looking at me from the ceiling. It was absolutely, Gary's not the word. But the next morning, I asked my mother. I said to my mother, there was an old lady looking at me. I would have been about 10 or 11 at the time. And my mother just asked me, what did she look like? And I told her. And she said, that was your granny. Now, my mother may have just said that to placate me and to, you know, calm me down and play the whole thing, play it down. But she said I had described my grandmother. Whether or not it was her, I don't know. But yeah, a few things like that have happened over the years. I tend to kind of believe them, don't believe them. It's just something that happens.
Well, David, it's been lovely reacquainting myself with you.
I think I'll probably use a third of what we have recorded here. I joke, of course. I can chop it up any way I want. And and a scary era. I can chop it up anyway. Could you do a Liam Neeson at all? No. Would you do a Liam? Can you do it? Because David's very good at impressions, so he is.
I will find you.
I'll tell you.
I know your name. We'll be coming after you.
We'll send the boys around to nail your knees to the door.
Thanks very much, David. That was brilliant. Bye.
What an old smoothie the squire is. I hope you enjoyed today's inaugural Scary Era show. Thanks to the good people at Paranormal UK for putting up with me for the last hour. They're going to retire to their boudoir to decide whether it's worth doing another one. But if you've been impressed and you'd like to get involved with all the old strap me to a pig and roll me in the mud top of the morning and the bottom of the evening shenanigans malarkey, we'd love to hear from you. Email paranormalireland@protonmail.com. Tell us your ghostly Irish story now, won't you? You won't see what I'll be giving you for Christmas. I'll go, so mind yourself and don't get your leg caught in the door of your bicycle. From myself, Mark Manning, take care, because I care.